Taking a look at home renovation and repair on the program today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Our climate is changing. Maybe you've thought about how these changes will affect your home. Maybe you haven't. John Freiberger has. He's a Wisconsin registered home inspector, specializes in the evaluation of older structures, and of course owns Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. Talk to him about what areas of your home will be affected by climate change, and of course answer your other home improvement and repair questions as well. So I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. John Freiberger, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about some of the weather changes that we've seen in recent years, and then maybe just how they affect our homes.
Certainly. Well, we know the climate's changing.
Yeah.
We can argue about why, but we know statistically that the climate is changing. The 20-year averages for almost everything are increasing or decreasing. We know that we're a lot wetter. We can take a look at the last few years of Wisconsin, where we've got tremendous amounts of rain. We've had things that we've had, you know, once every 100 years, like I believe they called a bomb cyclone that hit Middleton and western Dane County last year and dropped 15 inches of rain basically in one short storm.
Yeah.
That's something that used to be a great rarity here. We're seeing 100-year events. That is a storm rainfall that's supposed to occur every 100 years, sometimes 2 and 3 times a year. So certainly, statistically, we can say that things are getting wetter. We take a look at our temperatures. We have a lot of highs, of record highs coming in. The other thing is we're having record high lows. So it isn't cooling off as much as at night as it used to. And then, weirdly enough, we're getting some really cold outbreaks in the winter, because it seems that what has happened, if I understand the climate guys on your program, is that the warming of the Arctic has caused instability in the Arctic jet stream. So we've got the wobble, and we get these polar vortexes coming down all the way from north of Hudson's Bay. So last winter, we had a couple of days at 27 below zero here in Madison and colder in northern Wisconsin. So oddly, we're getting hotter, we're getting colder, and we're getting wetter. The only thing we're not getting right now is drier.
Well, obviously, this has got to have some impact on our homes.
It is, and it's real worrisome, Larry. We were talking before the program of some of the problems that we're seeing with certain types of masonry veneers, where we're seeing really precipitous failures, decay in sheathing, decay in framing in newer homes. But I'm getting more and more concerned now about the masonry on our older houses. And we've got some houses built in the 20s and 30s, houses built in the 50s and 60s, where basically we had the veneer without much of an airspace in back of them. We didn't have weeps at the bottom. We didn't flash the window sills. We didn't slant the capstones for drainage. So we did not follow really good practices for shedding and draining water. Well, these houses have performed well for the past 50, 60 years because they've got wood sheathing. And the nice thing about wood is that it has to stay wet for a while before it really rots. And they were wrapped with felt, 15-pound felt. And 15-pound felt is still one of the best weather-resistant barriers we can put on a house. The reasons for that are really complicated, so rather than have me explain it, take my word for it. But what I'm concerned with, what happens with brick is brick is called a reservoir cladding. That is, it holds water, like a reservoir.
Sure.
So it gets wet, and water goes through the brick. I can guarantee any veneer on any house will leak within 30 seconds of driving rain. So what's happened in the past is we get long periods where it dries out, either heat from the inside of the house in the cooler months or sun from the outside, so the brick simply dries out, and it dries out the wall and back. But now when we have, think of the month of June, Larry, we had only 3 consecutive days without rain. Just why you could not make hay in Dane County. Well, that brick now is wetted. So what is happening behind that brick? What is happening with the moisture being driven through that felt into the wall? So now these wood walls, though they are decay resistant, are now being wetted rather continuously. So I'm becoming really concerned about what we're going to be finding on our older stone and masonry houses that have performed so well, some of them for 60, 70, and 80 years. And I'm wondering, with the changes in the climate, whether they're going to continue to perform.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at that and you say, well, what the heck are you going to do about it, a house like that?
That's a very, very, very tough question. And I'm working with the condo association right now, and they're simply tearing off all their brick, and they're going to put vinyl siding on, and it's not going to look like it used to. It's going to look less expensive. But we have these beautiful houses, and are we going to be able to maintain them? Now, in Madison, where we have a very healthy real estate market, perhaps we are. But in other parts of the state where the real estate market is not as strong as Madison, people are going to have investments in cladding that they are going to hesitate to replace with modern cladding systems. So it is very worrisome about maintaining the value of our home, maintaining the health of the occupants of the home in case we get mold in the walls. And just the cost of maintaining our housing stock may increase fairly greatly due to climate change.
Boy. So the weather, the wet weather, let's talk about more about what happens or what we can do or improvements we should be looking at with this kind of wetter weather.
Well, improvements are when we're looking at remodeling the exterior of our houses. And when we need to follow the best practices. At this point, I'm suggesting that people not install thin veneer masonry on their buildings no matter what. I believe that the manufacturer's specifications are incorrect, and we're seeing precipitous early failures of all thin veneer masonry. Regular masonry, we have known since the 1960s and 1970s how to correctly lay brick. Actually, that's wrong, Larry. We have known since the year 1 BC, when Vitruvius wrote his books on architecture, how to lay brick. That we may not realize this. We go and look at those ruins in Rome. Is what we're seeing is the backup walls. So they don't look real pretty. But they had an airspace, and then they had a veneer on the front, which might have been marble, might have been another type of brick. But they had a big airspace, usually 2 to 4 inches, so that they could drain water, break up vapor pressure, and dry well. And so we've known this for 2,000 years. The Brick Institute of America and many other masonry institutes wrote all of this up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Our problem is that 90% of the masons don't follow them. 90% of the masons do not put brick on to meet the specifications of the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code. I almost never see a flashed windowsill with weeps. I just see windowsills that are poorly put together with flat bricks that drain water into the wall. It runs down the backside and there are no weeps at the bottom. And that, unfortunately, has become our standard building practice. Masonry, in general, is now done wrong, although we know how to do it right. So we need to get contractors educated about the consequences of doing things wrong. And unfortunately, that's where I come in and with the litigation I'm involved in. And we also have to have our local public inspectors, what's called the jurisdiction having authority, which could be a city or a township or even a county, need to actually come in and inspect these things and give them the old red tag when they are wrong. So we know what to do. We have to go out and do it by educating the trades and by also improving the standards that we have in many parts of the state, not all, but in many parts of the state for the public inspectors.
Talking today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison, and visiting with him a bit about home improvement during climate change. You may have some questions. A few people do already, I see. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You talked about weeping and around windows and so forth. Dan in Eagle has a question that may relate to that, John. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I'm living in a 167-year-old stone farmhouse. We've completely renovated the interior down to the stone, new stud walls, mechanicals, and everything, and we're to the point where we want to put in new windows. We've got the windows, but have some questions about the exact installation of the windows. The wood framing or the rough-in framing on the inside of the stone opening seems to be in fairly good condition. Just wondering, do we wrap that? Do we waterproof that part? You know, how does that differ putting in a window in a stone house compared to putting in a window in just a normal house?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The big issue with a stone house is we talked about reservoirs, and you have what's called a mass wall. So the walls of your house are a giant water reservoir. Now, depending on how big the overhangs or soffits are on your house, the height of the house, where it's located, prevailing wind, all of those things determine how wet the stone gets on your house. And how you live, how warm it is in the winter, the sunlight in the summer determines how quickly it dries. So what we have is we've got basically wet or damp stone, and we're going to try to put wood in it. So that obviously is problematical. Now, what is probably in your walls right now, those old rough bucks, are probably old-growth white pine. Now, they made schooners out of that. You know, they use it for schooners for a reason. It didn't rot real easily. So whatever you do, we're going to have to make sure that if you replace any of that wood, you do not use plain old what we call white wood, you know, fast-grown pine coming up from Georgia that has no resin in it and will, you know, will rot if the humidity is high. So you're going to have to be very careful about those rough bucks. My preference is not to wrap anything. My concern is that, you know, metal is a really good vapor retarder, isn't it? So if we're going to put metal over wood, and we want that wood to drain the outside, we are preventing that wood from drying because we have stopped the water vapor. So if some water vapor gets in from the stone, then we're not letting it out. It has to go back out through the stone, and that's a tricky proposition. So I would use as little cladding as possible. I'm hoping that the windows that you purchased are of good quality. A lot of windows we see now are they're made of what's called finger-jointed wood. So you look at the windows, and you see the sills and the jambs are made of little pieces that are glued together with like little fingers that sort of connect one to the other. That stuff rots quickly. So I don't know what you've purchased for windows. I'm hoping they're either solid wood or they are a product that can resist moisture such as fiberglass. But think about breathing and just remember when you're thinking about it that the stone wall is going to be damp and that moisture is going to be transmitted, and we want to be able to have that breathe out.
Yeah.
Does that help, Dan? It's hard, you know, without seeing the house to be more specific than that.
No, I totally understand. That's why when we built the interior walls, the interior wood walls, we were told to keep, you know, make sure that insulation in the walls and everything, that there's an air gap between that and the stone, and so it doesn't transmit the moisture into the insulation. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're aware that the stone needs to be able to breathe and weep.
Right. And the other thing, Dan, now since you've done some remodeling, you've added insulation, which was never there before. Your stone is now going to dry more slowly because you are not going to have the heat pushing through the wall from the inside to the outside to push that moisture to the exterior. So by remodeling, you've created a condition that is going to put the windows under more stress rather than less.
Yeah.
I would go out, probably do a little bit of online research. There are a couple of different websites that are dedicated basically to windows. And you may find some things on Stone House. I don't know anything. There's a wonderful archive of material that the Department of Interior keeps at their Department of Historic Preservation. They're called preservation briefs. So if you buy an Adobe house, they have a preservation brief on how to restore your Adobe. But you may want to take a look. Go to Department of Interior. Type in Department of Interior preservation briefs. See if something is going to pop up there, and you might even find that you could email somebody and say, "Here's what I'm doing." The Department of Interior lays out specifications for historic restoration. You've got a historic home, so they might be able to help you.
Yeah, makes good sense. Good luck, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates, our guest today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking home improvement today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. We'll go back to the phones for more questions as we've been visiting a bit about home improvement during climate change kinds of issues that we have here in the state and everywhere else. Mary in La Crosse County, it's your turn. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a I think the house is probably built in the early 50s, late 40s, and it's actually cement block with honest-to-goodness stucco with the wire mesh and everything. And there are some exterior cracks. Most of them I have cleaned out and treated with, like, clear silicone. But as far as something that I could cover that with that's going to help withstand the additional moisture.
Now, Mary, has that stucco been painted in the past?
No.
Good. That's excellent. Okay. So the only mistake we have so far is putting on that silicone caulk. So what you can do to maintain this old stucco is paint it with a silicate-based paint, not a latex paint, not the stuff that they sell as paint for cement. So you can go online, type in silicate paint. You'll find some from Germany. Oh, it's a Kiln, I believe it's called. You'll find ThuroSeal made in the U.S. The nice thing about most silicate paints, some you can order as a powder. So you can mix them with a little bit of water and a bonding agent, almost like toothpaste. Huh. And then you can take a fine brush and you can brush them right into those little cracks and fill the cracks. And then you mix it with a little more water so it becomes a paint and paint over the surface. The cracks completely disappear then. But the silicate type paint, this is probably a Portland cement based stucco, but it might have some lime content as well, so it might be getting a little bit permeable. So the application of a silicate paint to consolidate it and to preserve it against moisture intruding would probably be a good idea, because as you said, you have metal lath. Now, that was galvanized metal lath, but the galvanizing is sacrificial, so if it gets wet for some period of time, eventually it's going to start rusting. And usually when stucco fails, it is because the wire lath is rusting. The steel molecules gather oxygen molecules and get bigger, and we get what's called rust jacking. The wire lath actually expands in size and blows the stucco off the house. Does that help?
Yeah, that sounds scary. Okay, so if I use the silicate paint, what if I don't, does the house need to be painted? Could I just do the repair and leave it as is?
I think you could probably do the repair. It's difficult without seeing it. Usually, the problem with stucco is I have to look at it. And sometimes I have to do a little acid testing and things. I've got to figure out what type of stucco it is. And when yours was built in the late 40s or the early 50s is when we were making a big transition between lime-based stucco and Portland-based stucco. So I don't know exactly what this stucco is. Now, if you're in La Crosse County, you're fairly close to the city of La Crosse, so you're going to find a couple of plasterers in La Crosse. The guys are probably my age, but they're actually going to understand something about interior plaster and stucco. So it might be worth getting on the phone and making a couple local calls and see if you can find an older gentleman who remembers the stuff and knows how to do it, who can come out and take a look at it.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Should be able to find that.
You should be able to. I know there is a preservation brief on stucco, but it is not terribly useful. I have it in my library, but it doesn't give you a lot of repair information.
There you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Tammy in Milwaukee, will go to you now. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. So I have a well and a sump pump at my house. But the problem is that the sump pump that is supposed to only receive gray water has water flowing into it constantly. Part of the wall where the pipe comes into the sump pump is cracked away inside the crock, and water literally just flows in from around the pipe. So I don't know if I want to call a septic person or a plumber or a well person. Now, we do have, our well is a bit of ever flowing, so it was capped properly when we bought the house. There is a lot of water in spring, but even now, the sump pump is still running all the time, and it's just the gray water. But it is groundwater coming into it.
Mm-hmm. So you are in a rural area, Tammy, is that right?
Yes.
You're not on city
correct.
Sewer or city water. And
right.
It sounds like what you've got is a case of what we call hydrostatic head pressure. Is that the soil moisture in so many places in Wisconsin due to the rain has come way up. In places of Dane County, it's above grade. There are places where you can see the soybeans in the field that weren't harvested 2 years ago because there's now a foot of water there. And that is what is probably happening to you, is you are probably developing hydrostatic head pressure. So you probably, there are various people that do water collection systems in basements. Now, some of them I think are actually franchises, and others are local people, but they usually specialize in basement water issues, and they're not plumbers. So they're used to putting in interior drain lines, revising sump pits, et cetera, et cetera. So I would check under basement waterproofers, basement water collection, and then have two or three of those folks stop by and take a look at it. And one of them is going to sound smarter than the others and see what their recommendation is. They will also probably look outside your house. Are you in sort of a valley with hills nearby where there's a lot of permeation coming into the soil? Are you near a stream? Is it possible that your capped well is now actually has outflow below grade and has become an artesian well, quite literally, like the one at Villa Louis that shoots into the air 4 feet. So you're going to need to check the water sources and then figure out how to contain them and collect the clear water and get it ejected to the exterior far enough to your house that it doesn't just recirculate. So an expert would be good, and it's not going to be a plumber. Start with basement waterproofers. Google online. You'll probably find many in your area if you're in Milwaukee County, Waukesha County, Washington County, etc.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much, Tammy, for calling. And Janelle and Hilbert, your turn. Hi, Janelle.
Hi, it's that time of year. We're running the window air conditioners constantly, and they're getting older.
Yes.
What is more cost-effective for us, a whole house fan or possibly getting a central air unit?
A central air unit is going to be your least expensive. The reason is, as my friend Joe Stilbrick says, if radon was valuable, we would mine it with whole house fans. Whole house fans are going to pull into your house humidity you don't want, radon from the soil, and could have some very nasty health consequences. So you're going to be much better off with central air where you can dehumidify. I mean, we're talking about Wisconsin becoming wetter and wetter. We need to dry our houses out. A whole house fan wets our house because what we do at night is we open the windows and we pull in this outside air that, as it's cooling, is approaching 100% humidity. So if we want to grow mold on our drywall, the whole house fan is a good way to do it. So I would – and thank you for asking that question, and pardon me for raving. But we have to remember whole house fans are basically chicken coop vent fans. And it's something where we ended up selling them to people as the, quote, cheap alternative to central air, but it really isn't. For the sake of your house, sake of your health, and everything else – go ahead and add central air. And when you're adding central air, look at the energy rating. You want to have a SEER 13 or better. So get an idea of what your utility bills are going to be with the new central air. You're probably going to find them dropping significantly by getting rid of the old sash shakers that you have there now, which may be SEER 8s.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, Another question, though. We do have a low-lying property that floods on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to get that central air unit on, like, a platform then?
Certainly.
Sure.
Okay. They actually can attach it to the side of your house with a cantilever bracket, so you can put it a couple feet off of the ground if you like.
There you go. Thanks, Janelle. Appreciate the call. Lynn in Viroqua, we're on to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, thank you. I have an outside shed. Was just cleaning it out yesterday, and there is a lot of what I would call powdery sawdust. And I'm assuming it's insect debt. It's a very old shed, some mm-hmm. of the actual kind of log-like structure.
Certainly.
Rather than sod supports.
Powder post beetles.
That is correct, Larry. Lynn, what has happened? And I was surprised by this. I have an old wood box in the shed next to my house, and I have never seen a powder post beetle in it. This summer, I have powder post beetles, and I know they were there. But powder post beetles need 85% humidity to thrive, because otherwise they desiccate and they die. So again, you're pointing out another element in Wisconsin, due to climate change, due to things being wetter and more humidity, is these insect pests are now going to be more of pests. Now, unfortunately, I don't know how to control them. I guess we'll have to get Phil Pelletieri on here to answer that.
There's actually a paint of that, as part of it is borax. It's a borax product that you can paint right on the wood itself. It's not a paint in that you're going to change the color or anything, but it soaks into the wood itself. And I think if you were to go online to get the specifics of it, that borax-based product can work very well in preventing powder post beetles.
Sounds like good advice, Larry, because even if no matter what you do to keep the shed dry, I mean, this wood box is in my carriage barn under a roof, and I have powder post beetles, and I know it is nothing but the humidity that has allowed them to come back and thrive.
No.
Thank you for that question, Lynn.
Thanks, Lynn. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dennis in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Question I have is looking to either paint, probably either epoxy or put rubber mats onto a garage floor, and just looking at options because it's a... built in 85, but it's slight fitted, but trying to figure out what options I have for protecting the floor from the salt.
I've seen epoxies work really well. The only concern I have with epoxies is, do you see signs of dampness coming out of the floor? And some people have garages literally in their basement, or it might be a tri-level, where the garage is half a story down from the backyard. So the garage floor has a tendency to have hydrostatic head pressure and moisture come up through the floor. If that is the case, it'll have a tendency to blister off the epoxy paint. So is your garage floor above grade?
It's above grade. We just moved into a condo, and we're just doing repairs and things like that are what would work for us. It's a two-car garage, but trying to figure out, the floor probably needs to be degreased or cleaned for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, I looked at epoxies, and then their Rust-Oleum has supposedly a coating that their statement is 20% better than last longer than epoxy, and then I've looked at rubber mats you can buy for your garage and things like that. So,
and the problem with the rubber mats is they get moisture underneath them and salt underneath them, and then they trap it, and it'll cause increased surface spalling. So I think you're probably going to be better off with one of the coatings. What you may want to do is, if you can get a small amount of it, is do a test batch one place where you're perhaps the surface is pretty spalled or eroded, to make sure that it is indeed going to stick. Because it's a great product, but if it fails, it's really difficult to deal with because you've got these patches of loose epoxy. So be a little bit careful. Read directions very carefully and maybe do a test patch and let it for a couple months. Good place to put a test patch is where your front tires tend to come to rest, because you can test that patch by turning on the car and turning the power steering a couple times. And if it pops right off the floor after you've turned the front wheel a couple times, your test has failed.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve in Stoughton, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Larry and John. Thanks very much. This has been a great discussion, and it's got my wheels spinning on a possible project. My daughter has a pre-1900 farmhouse exterior full brick around a stone foundation. And so you guys have been talking about brick. John talked about brick earlier. And then there was a discussion about painting the stucco. And so I'm thinking about weather, moisture, breathability. Can I use the silica paint to paint the brick around the foundation? Would that act in the same manner as it would for the stucco?
No. The problem with the, especially on the foundation, is it really needs to breathe. So the stone foundation, so you're in Stoughton, so you're going to be a local, we call it sandstone. It's really a type of light limestone, right? Sort of sandy yellow color. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So that is going to suck in moisture below grade and is going to breathe it out to the exterior and to the interior. If we put a sealant over that, that stone is actually going to start spalling and coming apart. So what is going to happen is it's going to be moist. It's going to freeze. The water vapor is going to turn into ice crystals, and it's actually going to blow the stone apart. So when I do see people who've had elastomeric paints or Portland stucco or something put over the stone foundation and it's failing, I say, good, let it fail. Scrape it off so that that stone can breathe out. If that stone doesn't breathe, if she has an old house and the floor joists are going into that stone, and then there's what's called nogging between them, that is the joist space are filled with stone, by putting something on the exterior, you can rot off the tails of all of your floor joists.
Oh boy.
So let it breathe out, and that is really the best. Is the brick on the house in fairly good condition?
That's kind of the problem. I'm doing some tuck pointing on the brick, and I was thinking, well, maybe it would be good to try to preserve the remaining joints a little bit more with some type of paint.
Yeah, what I would suggest you do is to go ahead and just point the foundation. Stone foundation, you want to go to our website, Educated Homeowner, click on Masonry, and then click on the mortar mix for the house of that period. You're going to be using a lime-based mortar, and that's what you should be using on the bricks as well. You do not want to use Portland cement mortar on those bricks because it's going to cause additional cracking.
Hmm.
Thank you so much, John. I value your inputs very much. And Larry, thanks for the show.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Appreciate it very much. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn.
Hi, guys. Thanks a bunch.
Sure thing.
I've got a horse barn with an indoor riding arena and a living area. The arena is heated with Resners, and then the living area and the stall barn is heated with geothermal. And there is a Venmar air exchange for the winter. So This year I noticed mold on the tack, the saddles and bridles, and a moldy smell in the place. So I got a 70-pint dehumidifier for the tack room in the living area, and that I also swapped through to the stall barn as well. But I'm wondering, what advice can you give me about dealing with this immediately?
Well, it sounds
and then
like
the other question is how to find a trustworthy person to evaluate it if need be.
Well, you're probably the trustworthy person.
Thank you.
And you're doing exactly what I'm doing. I have dehumidifiers in both of my tack rooms and in the lounge living space to keep the humidity down. And we all know that horse barns in the winter, I've got 25 horses, and they breathe out many, many, many pints. So I have, with our heater system, we are using 50% outside air during the winter to try to keep the humidity lower. And I am actually going to be putting a central fan cupola on the roof that I can occasionally turn on to move additional air out. And we, at times, are moist. We've not had mold problems in the horse area because of the amount of air that comes in. And, of course, we do not have a real well-sealed stable, which is good. But dehumidification in the other areas is the best thing to do. It sounds like you've got a newer facility, so you probably have a vapor barrier wrap around the tack rooms and things. If not, you're probably going to want to install one, which can be done either with a vapor barrier material or with a vapor barrier paint.
Does that help, Diane?
Barrier. We do have a vapor barrier.
Good.
I know that.
So then you should be able to control the moisture in your tack rooms and things with your dehumidifiers. And the answer in the stable area is as much outside air as you can put into there in the winter when you have the doors closed.
So should I be concerned about the mold that I see?
Yes and no. Usually what you're going to see, are they like little white puffy blossoms?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that most likely is Aspergillus. Aspergillus is extremely common on the exteriors of Wisconsin. I mean, most leaves on most trees have Aspergillus on them. It is not. I am not a fungal expert, but I'm sure you can Google Aspergillus and you can Google mold issues because there's a lot of good information online. But that is a type of mold that usually you can just wash off with some Dawn dish soap and detergent. I think that the toxins that it releases are very, very, very low compared to the black stuff like Stratibatra. So it's a tough mold to deal with. We find it in people's basements. If the basement is damp, we find it all over the exterior of houses. It needs 85% surface humidity, which means 80% general humidity in the barn. So you really need to try to keep that horse barn below 80% summer and winter. So get yourself a little humidistat and stick it on the wall and sort of see how your barn is performing. In the winter, you may have to have your HVAC guy come out and add a little bit of additional air. The other thing you can do, if it's a small barn, if it's six horses or so, what I would do is I'd put in an air-to-air heat exchanger.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
But, you know, with a big barn, you just can't do it, Larry. The volume of the air is too big. But if you've got four or six horses and it's a fairly tight modern barn, put in a heat exchanger. That way you're pumping in dry air all winter and you're blowing out the wet air.
That makes a lot of sense. Diane, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector. He owns Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. Our lines are all filled. We've got some emails. You can email at ideas@wpr.org. David emailed to ask what options he has for adding air to an older home with a hot water furnace with radiators.
Well, we're just going to talk to Diane about the PTAC systems. And that basically, unless you are able to put in all of the ductwork required for a central air system, the split units, Mitsubishi, they all seem to be Japanese made for some reason, but the Mitsubishis have been around for a long time. The nice thing about the PTAC systems is the bad thing is you need one per room. The good thing is you have one per room. So in the evening, the one in the master bedroom can be running and the living room is shut off. And during the day, the one in the living room can be running and the master bedroom is shut off. So the split systems will generally have one or two exterior compressor systems, and then you'll have line sets running to the systems in the room. The good thing about them is they're adaptable, and you can put them in without the ductwork. If you're real clever, you can hide them. You know, the problem with them, Larry, is these big white things hanging on your wall and make the master bedroom feel a little bit like a motel room. But sometimes I've had 1950s houses that had the sliding doors above the closets. We've put them in there behind wood grills so you can't see them. So you can find clever ways of situating them so that they don't mess up the aesthetics of your house. But talk to a good quality HVAC person and see if that can be done. Now, if you've got a boiler, the question is, do you have a steam or a hot water boiler? We know that hot water boilers now can be 96 to 98% efficient.
This one's hot water.
Great. Okay. So when we have steam boilers where we don't have the efficiency, sometimes I'll talk to people about let's get rid of the boiler and put in forced air to get the 96% efficiency. But if he has hot water, then it is probably not going to pay. And the PTAC type system is probably going to be the most cost-effective option. What I don't like about them is it doesn't give us the opportunity to filter the air that a central system does. And now that we can get like MERV 13 filters, a standard filter from April Air, Space Guard is at least a MERV 11, we can really clean up our inside air. We can't do that with a PTAC, but at least we can cool the house down and control the humidity.
And Diane in Madison had a question relating to that, as you said, John. Diane, are you there? Did that help?
Yeah. Yes, hi. So what about, perfect timing, huh?
Yes.
What about for heating a house, a small house?
Yes, if you are using the heat pump style, you can use it. They are good, I think at least to 25 below zero now. They've been much improved. And again, in Madison, you've got several very good heating contractors you can talk to, and there's another one in Black Earth as well. So I would take a look at a couple of different systems and discuss it with them, take a look at your costs, and especially in a smaller home, it might be quite effective both for heat and for cooling.
There you go. Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it.
Good question.
Mary in New London, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband and I need to replace our 16-year-old water heater and talk to our local plumber about the pros and cons of a tankless water heater. He was less than enthusiastic about them, and I wanted to get your opinion as well.
Sometimes it depends upon how your house is plumbed. There are houses where you will have to walk a quarter mile to get to the master bathroom, and you know, and then the kitchen's a quarter mile the other way. Well, then you're running a lot of water through a tankless before you get warm water to wherever it's going. So sometimes perhaps a tank-type heater with a recirculator makes more sense. Sometimes the tankless is just fine. Where we have things like cottages, I always recommend the tankless. Where we have houses where the bathrooms and the kitchens maybe are within a couple of meters of each other, I think the tanklesses work just fine. But if you've got a big house and things are really spread out, or if you've got a recirculation system, then a storage tank system may make sense. So your plumber is probably looking at that and evaluating. Maybe he's less than enthusiastic because he thinks you're going to be running a lot of excess water through there before you get warm water to your shower in the morning. So I would discuss it with him perhaps a little bit more. Plumbers and electricians are some of the best educated tradespeople we have in Wisconsin. And I really find that most of them are really quite reliable. It's nice to say something good about somebody in the building trades. But because of the licensing requirement and the amount of education that is needed for plumbers and electricians, most of them are more than competent.
There you go. Thank you so much, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. Diane in Milwaukee, it's your turn.
Well, hi. Thanks for such a great show. I just wanted to call and share the experience of a relative that also had a sump pump problem that sounded very similar to the prior caller.
Yeah.
And they had tried a few things and nothing was working, but simply extending with, I think, a garden hose to get the water away from the house solved the problem. It within a day or two, they realized that that was the problem. It solved it. And the sump pump wasn't running continually anymore.
That is correct, Diane. If you recall, I mentioned to our other friend that we wanted to make sure we didn't recycle that water.
Yeah.
But not a garden hose. If you take a look at the specifications on the sump pump box, you will find that if you decrease that 2-inch or 1.5-inch outlet down to garden hose size, that pump is going to work much, much harder. So you want to have the correct size hose. Now, usually you can buy that fairly cheap black flexible PVC, or you can even put it in smooth PVC. At my house, what I did is I have it going all the way out to the ditch at the road, and it is buried underground in 3-inch pipe. And that works really well. That water leaves my yard entirely, and I don't have to move it when I mow.
There you go.
Useful comment.
Yeah, useful comment indeed. Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it. Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I've got a question about a foundation in an old, very old house. It was built in 1890. The basement has actually got several different types of foundation depending where you are in it at the time. Some is poured concrete. There are some corners that are stacked brick. But the place I'm having the problem is it's all huge boulders, old fieldstone.
Oh, wow.
And the mortar is all just crumbling away. I mean, I can sweep the floor and a few weeks later go down and there'll be a layer of mortar dust near the bottom.
Right.
What kind of process has to be done for this? Is there a way to, like, tuck point it and redo it that way? Or is, okay, that's the best way?
Yes, and you can do it yourself. And if you go to Educated Homeowner, click on mortar, I'm sorry, click on masonry, then click on mortar, you will find two bits of information on this old mortar. And I provide you with a specification for how to do it. And the mortar that I have in there has got a little bit of Portland and a lot of lime. So I call it a good throwing mortar. You can take it off your trowel, throw it against the wall, and it sticks. But you've got fieldstone, so you've got to maintain that mortar. Those things will come loose on you. The other thing that you probably have is the lower part of your wall is probably single-width stone. It may only be 8 or 10 inches thick while the top of the wall is 24 inches. And if that mortar starts crumbling, that wall is going to lose its capacity to support the heavy stone above and the soil outside. So it'd be very good to get working on that. Now, just real briefly, since we've had a couple calls on this, is what you're going to do is you're going to mix up the soft mortar. Though with fieldstone, you can use a harder mortar. But you want to have compatible mortar with what you have there now. If you put a hard Portland cement mortar like you buy at the hardware store and, you know, the ready-to-mix sort of stuff, that is going to seal water into the wall and cause the original mortar to all fall apart. So we want a breathable mortar that expands and contracts just like the old mortar. And if you read what I've written on the website, that information should be good enough that you can actually do the work yourself. And it is time-consuming because you may have to pull out several inches of mortar in some areas, and you have to put it in what are called lifts, so a little bit at a time. You can't just jam it full of mortar. But you should find all the information that you need at Educated Homeowner.
And it's educatedhomeowner.
Oh, Larry, we'd go through this every time. One of these days I will write it down, whether it's .net or .com.
We'll look it up because there is a difference, and we'll get Tyler or somebody to take a look at that. Jill's probably
it is indeed .net. I'm going to try to get that into my brain cells, Larry. So the next time we ask, I'll say, Larry, it's .net.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Ann in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have an old duplex. It was built in 1925, and we would like to disacquire it. We want to sell it. But the basement walls have something that looks like leprosy on them. They're all peeling off.
Mm-hmm.
Some time ago, we had a waterproof paint put on, and that's peeling off, and then the brick underneath is sort of crumbling.
Oh, dear.
Yes, indeed. So what I'm hoping is that somebody with a lot more money than we have purchases this place. And fixes it. But is there any kind of a cosmetic, quick, helpful fix that we could do to this place to spiff it up a little bit? Because really, it looks like it's very unpleasant.
And let me ask you this. Now, you said brick. Is it brick or is it concrete block?
Well, it's concrete block.
Good. Okay. That's a whole lot easier than brick.
Oh, hooray.
Oh, yes. No, definitely a whole lot easier. And, of course, the waterproofing paint is great as long as you put it on the outside. On the inside, it just peels off, so you've already discovered that. I think what I would probably do you have a lot of storage in your basement, or is it pretty clean and open?
Tons and tons.
There's
tons of storage.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah, tons of things stored in the basement.
Well, what I usually suggest to people that are getting things ready to sell is to pressure wash the walls and just clean them up. And you get rid of the loose paint. It doesn't look great, but it doesn't look terrible. But I don't think for selling the house, talk to whoever the broker is and say, is it worth doing anything here? Your broker may say, no, it really isn't. People don't care. They care what the kitchen looks like and that sort of thing. It may not be worth the effort, especially if you have a lot of stuff in the basement, Ann.
There you go, Ann. Thank you so much for calling. John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector. He specializes in evaluating older structures. His firm, Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. It's great to have him with us. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. But we'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back. By the way, Nick and Ellison Bay reminded me that the borax product for powder post beetles is called Tim Bor, and I had forgotten. Tim, it's Tim Bor. Yes. He says it works very well. We'll be back with John Freiberger right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Talking home improvement on the program today, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. Great to have John back. He comes by every couple of months to talk with us. Certainly, if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. All our lines are filled right now, and we have a number of emails as well. Trina emailed to say they're looking to build in about 3 years, and they're thinking about ICF construction for a number of reasons, she said, and that's insulating concrete form I think,
right,
is the correct word for that. Would this type of construction be more climate change proof? We've been talking climate change a little bit. Would it be more climate change proof than a typical stick-built home?
Oh, they're looking at making the entire house out of ICFs. Ah, that's interesting. Well, they're still going to have to insulate because I don't think they're going to have the insulation for the sidewalls that they need with just the ICFs. The issues that I've seen with ICFs is people not really knowing how to install them, not having enough rods in them, the walls tending to not have been braced well enough so that we've ended up with a lot of crooked poured concrete. The exterior is going to make a big difference. Now, if you're going to put an exterior finish system on the exterior, you might think, well, ICFs are great. I can go right over it. But actually, no, you can't because we need to have an airspace. So I think that this is really a case where you want to talk to an architect who is maybe a member of the Green Building Council. And you want to think about not just the insulation value or the cost of the structural work, but you want to think about what cladding is going to be on the exterior and how you're going to back vent it and drain it with a rain screen system. And the ICFs may be more difficult to use because of the problems of making attachments to them than a stick-built home. So you may find you just want to use them for the foundation, but above grade, you may want to go stick-built. Yeah. So it's a very complicated question and really needs a design professional to help you with it.
Let's take John in Galena, Illinois next. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on. Just a side note on that ICF, I have a bunch of questions, but we just did a complete ICF building, and we put stone veneer on the exterior with a 5-inch wall line, and we used that Mortair vent between there. Do you think that's a good barrier, or was that not enough?
It helps. My problem is I haven't had enough experience with the various claddings over them. Usually what we see is the exterior insulation finish system, and those are about 90% failure rate. So what you're using may indeed be better than what is usually used. But I don't want to opine on it because I haven't taken many of them apart.
Okay.
We also laid the stones in lime-based mortar.
Oh, excellent.
Yes, we're trying to make it look like an old building. It's on interior, exterior. But do you think that two inches interior exterior foam was not enough insulation then as well?
Well, it really depends. I've not ever sat down and analyzed the wall because I'm not sure exactly what happens with the concrete that is in the voids. We lose the voids, so we lose R1 there. To what extent does the concrete transmit? If we had 2 inches of foam, and now that is an open cell foam as well, isn't it? That might be an R12 or R13 wall, but it might be a little bit less than that because of the transference through the concrete. And I'm designing everything in the mid-20s at this point.
Oh.
Now, the nice thing about a lower insulation wall is you're going to get your stone on the exterior to dry better, but the house is going to be a little bit more expensive to heat. So it's one of these things. It's like life in general. There's always trade-offs, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. John, did that help?
It did. I had an original question, and I apologize. You had mentioned earlier about not recommending installing the thin cut veneer stones,
right,
on homes.
Not the way it's currently installed. And you know, what I usually use for the standard, I know there's a bunch of manuals, but I use a veneer association manual that I'm sure you're familiar with. It's got good detailing and everything else in it. But what I'm finding is those systems are failing. And that's a great manual. It's well thought out. But I think what is going on, and we're going to have to get into a little bit of science here, is I think we've got vapor drive problems with thin veneer because we don't have 3/16 of an inch in back of them. In theory, Larry, when we nail on the wire mesh, it's supposed to be a little drainage behind the thin veneer, and we put a weep screed down at the bottom. So in theory, if moisture comes through, it comes out in the bottom. The problem that we're finding is that when we heat this wall, we're getting such a vapor drive inside that we're blowing vapor through the twin water-resistant barriers. Now, most people put a layer of felt, 15-pound, 30-pound, and then we have a Tyvek in back of it. And we're finding that we're getting water vapor forced right through those two. So at this point, when I'm looking at thin veneer, I want a 3/16 or better, a half to three-quarter inch airspace in back of them. Now, sometimes you can do that with the green meshes and things. But by the time you get all this done correctly, you may as well just go ahead and lay veneer, because our price has gone up to the point where we may as well lay brick,
yeah,
or lay stone. But we don't have a lot of information on this, but I've been involved in several of these now where they were more or less installed correctly, and we still had rotting sheathing and rotting studs. One house, it was after 7 years, they had to abandon part of the house due to the mold in the walls. So I'm very concerned at this point, even for the good quality masons that are going to the manufacturer's specifications and following the Thin Veneer Association manual. Even there, I'm still worried that we have not fully appreciated the science here, and that vapor drive, which is a very long and complicated explanation we're not going to get into, is perhaps our enemy.
Mm. John, does that help?
Sure. It sounds like I've got to tell people just to put some siding on then. You're taking my work away from them.
Well, no, talk them into a good poured brick ledge, weeps at the bottom, flash the sills the way they're supposed to, flash the lintels the way they're supposed to, do what 98% of the masons don't do, do it right, use the Brick Institute technical bulletins, especially 7, B, C, and D, and... good brick is going to last for literally hundreds of years as long as we've got that airspace in back. That airspace, Larry, once we get that airspace, it breaks up the vapor drive.
Yeah.
It just stops it. And that is you get a good brick house with some sort of air gap, at least 3/16 of an inch. And that's how some of these old farmhouses with the soft, wet Janesville brick are still surviving, is it's breaking up the vapor pressure. So that's a little technical wonky here, but I don't want to condemn an entire industry. I want to say there is a way of doing this right. And as I said before, we've known it for 2,000 years how to do it right. I'm sure John does as well. So, John, you just want to sell them a more expensive product that in the long run is going to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah. John, does that help?
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, it sounds like John wants to do things right. Yeah, he's a guy that...
He does. Most tradespeople want to do things right. And Larry, we're finding it's a lack of education that is really the problem.
No. Jerry in La Crosse, your turn now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have about 8x8 well room attached to my basement with about a 5-foot-high concrete ceiling and then a slab on top of that. And the well pipe goes through that ceiling. Unfortunately, the previous owner, when we put in a new well, knocked out a chunk of that concrete ceiling, and now when it rains, it leaks. Mm-hmm. I called basically waterproofing folks. They don't do ceilings.
Yeah.
I tried waterproofing that slab to no avail.
Well, here's a suggestion for you. I don't know when that well was put in, but you can't do that anymore. We can't have these below-grade wells. What about just extending that well up above grade 18 inches, putting concrete block into the opening that goes into the basement if there is one, drill some holes in the floor of it, and then just fill it with pea gravel. Just get rid of it.
Do you think that would work, Gary?
Well, I don't know.
Talk to your well guy. What you're going to find is you're going to be much less likely to get pollution in your well if you are 18 inches above grade, and then you don't have this thing to maintain. The other thing, that long-term what happens is those wells have a lot of steel rod in them, and when the water starts getting through and into that steel rod expands and starts rust-jacking, and then the whole cap falls apart. So you might find somebody who can waterproof it, and 2 years from now you start seeing caps in the concrete, and then you go, I wish I could have just gotten rid of this thing. And I think you can very easily. There are some rules on how you get rid of it, but any of your local well guys are going to be able to guide you on that.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Deborah in Brown Deer, your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, you guys. Thank you so much for the show. We have a 1950 limestone house, and there was an addition put on in 69, and it's got a hip roof. Well, that's leaking. It has a basement foundation. When they added it on, they added a basement, and the water leaks. Now it doesn't leak. It pours, actually, through to the bottom. And I want to know the best possible questions to ask. We've had three people come out, and we've got 30,000, 19,000, and a 12,000 estimate. I want to know the best questions to ask, and we've gotten two different suggestions for vents. So I'm wondering, what should we be looking for?
Okay, I'm a little confused because we were talking about both the roof and we're talking about basement leaks.
No, I'm just saying the roof leaks. When it leaks into the basement also.
Leaks into the basement. Oh, so we've got flashing that's going into the walls and running through the walls into the basement. So we've got big problems. So we need a good quality roofing contractor. I would suggest that you find a GAF certified roofing contractor. GAF certifies roofing contractors, and they can actually give you a lifetime labor and material warranty on your new roof. So your run-of-the-mill, the guy who just bought a pickup truck and a hammer, is not going to be a GAF certified contractor. CertainTeed, other companies may have certified contractors as well, but I tend to spec a lot of GAF shingles because they've had the fewest callbacks. So I would start with that, and then I think you may pay a little more, but you're never going to have to do anything to that roof for the rest of your life. You should have very good peace of mind. If we've got water coming down into walls and we're getting mold and wood decay, we want to get on that right away. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
So GAF.
GAF. George Alice Fred shingles. And they have a good website. You can take a look at all the shingles there. Larry, let me add one other thing to that because we're talking about climate change. We want to talk about albedo effect. We want light-colored shingles. We want light-colored siding. I'm looking at so much siding now that is brown or a gray where the siding is beginning to melt just because of the sunlight. The same thing with our roofs. Maybe a black roof looks pretty on your house, but it also is going to give you a 200-degree attic. So start thinking about reflectivity when you're looking at shingles, looking at exterior paints, and looking at siding So we can send some of that extra heat back up into the atmosphere instead of soaking into our home where we're going to have to air condition it away.
All right. Deborah, thank you so much. Jane in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Larry. I'm really interested in this whole house fan versus a fan on an air conditioner, and if they are the same.
No. The central air conditioner system is going to have a fan system, Space Guard and April Air, which are basically identical with different labels on it, are the usual good quality filters that you see on central air. And MERV 13, MERV 11 are the sort of the standard sizes. A MERV 11 is the lower type, but every time you move air through it, it takes out 40% of the dirt. The MERV 13, I think, takes out 50%. So you really can clean up the air in your house. Whole house fan, I'm glad you asked that, because we're going to push maybe 20,000 cubic feet per minute into an attic that vents 5,000. So we're going to create a lot of back pressure in the attic. Well, maybe we've had some mice and bats up there. Guess what gets aerosolized and pushed back down into the house? It's whatever is in your attic. And this is where some of the health deficits from using whole house fans can come from. So when you put in a whole house fan, you have to change your attic venting so that you're not pressurizing the venting. By the time you do all of that, you may as well just buy a central air conditioner.
Yeah. That makes good sense. Jane, there you go. Thank you. Irvin and Burnett, we'll go to you now. Hi, Irvin.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on 12-inch cement board siding. A lot of places are starting to tear it back off. I was wondering if there's a big problem with it.
The answer is yes. I believe that one of the companies that made a lot of it has simply stopped making it due to class action lawsuits. Their 16-foot-long pieces in the sun, especially with darker paint, broke into three separate pieces. The expansion contraction really became a problem. The nailing became a problem. Now, that being said, the James Hardie company makes a good product, but you've got to install it at least to the James Hardie standards, and I wouldn't stop there. Now, we had this discussion with John earlier about thin veneer masonry, where my opinion right now is the industry standard is wrong. What I want to see done with a James Hardie cemented siding is have a back drain system. That is, there is an air gap of at least 3/8 of an inch behind the siding. The major problem we're seeing with the Hardie siding is when it gets wet. When it gets wet, it ends up sort of melting. You know, it decalcifies, or the Portland cement comes out of it. So there's nothing wrong with the product. It's just that if you use the product, you need to put it on very well with a rain screen system. If you don't know what a rain screen system is, simply Google it. A lot of things will come up. My guess is that if you're interested in James Hardie siding, you could probably call their tech support and say, do you have a specification for a rain screen installation? And my guess is they probably have one. I have not been to their website recently, but it is a product that I've specified. But I have specified my own installation instructions to make sure that they would last, and so far I've had no callbacks in any of the designs that I've done, but I've looked at a lot of 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old installations where the siding was beginning to crumble around windows and doors and places where water was clinging to it.
Yeah. Thanks, Irvin, for calling. Appreciate it. Ed, we'll go to David in Amory next. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I just wanted to call with an experience about ICF forms.
Yeah,
I built a house of, in 2011, and it's a single story on grade on concrete floor, and I wanted it energy efficient, and I built the ICF forms. They were 2 1/8 on the inside, and 2 1/8 on the outside. Excuse me, and I think that gave me a little over R21 or 2. Then I had the contractor strip the outside with 2x2s, which are actually 1.5 inches, and we put an extra 1.5 inches on the outside. I wanted the majority of my insulation on the outside so I would get the flywheel effect, I guess they call it, where the concrete absorbs heat and then it gives you the heat back. And my floor does the same thing. And I faced the house south, and I burned the north side into a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I got I went to a glass company and got, I found out that the window manufacturers like Marvin and Anderson and Pella, they always just tell you low E glass. And I went to the window manufacturer and we went through all the calculations and this guy, or the glass manufacturer, not the window manufacturer.
Right.
And we put in special windows or special glass into the windows. I had Marvin put in three pane glass with a low E 180 on my south and a low E 270 on my north windows.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the long and the short of it is I have been ecstatic over this house. The colder it gets in the winter, the better the house functions.
Mm-hmm.
I have left for 5 and 6 days at a time when it's 25 and 30 below zero, and it uses the thermostat. I set it at 50, and the temperature stays at about 60 degrees. And in the summertime, it is incredibly easy to keep cool. I've got a little bitty air conditioner, and it, more for the humidity than for the coolness. I went a couple of years without an air conditioner. The humidity, however, was a little on the high side.
Yeah.
So I put in an air conditioner. But anyway, this thing has been I heat it with about 400 gallons of propane for the whole year, and that includes my domestic hot water and everything, too. So
it's doing a good job. Let's get a comment from our guest today, John.
David, one of the most important things you did is you used HS6 C270 glass. So your glass is probably 3 to 4 times more efficient than the glass in most homes as far as sun stop in the summer for heat gain and for heat loss in the winter. We forget that we build these houses and we may have an R30 exterior wall, and then we put these cheap windows in where that basically is an R2 window. So what you have done is you have quadrupled the value of your windows by doing this research and selecting the correct glass. So I compliment you on that. And that's a really good thought with which to close this program. When we're dealing with climate change, let's make sure that we analyze everything and take a look at some of the really good products that are out there that many people are simply not using so that we, like David, can have highly efficient, climate-resistant homes.
And your site again?
Is educatedhomeowner.com. .net. That will transfer you to the Freiberg Consulting website. Someday we'll get rid of that transfer, but you should find much useful information there.
John, I look forward to your next visit. You're back on October 10th. We'll do it all over again.
We will, and I think we've had so many masonry questions, and there's so many issues, Larry, that perhaps we'll focus on masonry again.
Yeah, not a bad idea. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Madison and Fitchburg. Oh, great to have him with us, and he'll be back on October 10th. And just a full disclosure thing, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is a WPR business sponsor, so that's great, too. Thank you all for listening. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston come by to answer your gardening questions. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.